Your last.
Go ahead, and I'll repeat it.
Your last concept for the struggle in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
I got a little different thought on that.
All right.
See what's going on. Why did God, when he kicked Adam and Eve out of the garden, put cherubim?
Angels,
so
I remember.
They can't get back in.
Right.
And everything flows, you know, from the Garden of Eden.
Right.
Those rivers flow out of there.
Right.
And they're real rivers.
Yeah.
So there's a real place.
It's gone now. I mean, it was wiped out in a flood. Well, but
also we know that Satan was able to approach God. So he knows the way. That entrance, or that entrance point.
Yeah.
And Israel is standing right in the way.
You think maybe there's some physical portal there? Yeah. Well, I tell you what. The question was: is there something? Is there more to it that struggles over? Well, that's a good point. All right. So in other words, they want to. It's not just a matter of pushing Israel out of there, but they want it for some other reason, or this Satan who is the author of it.
Right.
That's an interesting point. You know, the Jews will insist that the rock, underneath the Dome of the Rock there, that little outcropping rock that I talked about before, is precisely where Adam was created. And they'll trace it back to... I'm a little incredulous just because I think the flood pretty much redid the face of the earth. I will say that it is interesting that, because you mentioned that the reason God posted angels after Adam and Eve had been expelled from the garden was lest they eat of the tree and live forever. And when you go to Revelation 22 in the eternal state, there is the tree of life and there is a river flowing, and when we eat of it, life is given. This has nothing to do with anything, and it's a bit of a strange view of mine. Well, it's not really. I'll just tell you. I believe that Adam and Eve were immortal in the sense that they had access to the tree of life. I think mankind, though made in the image of God, is intrinsically liable to decay, intrinsically. And it was only because he had access to the tree of life that he was immortal, my argument for that is, number one, the tree of life shows up in the eternal state, and it's my persuasion that God has made us in such a way that we will forever be dependent upon him for life. We will not, even in immortality, will not be independent of God physically. We will celebrate our dependence upon him and his provision for us physically. To our attorney, I think immortality will be a very different state. There are other effects of sin and all of the propensity to disease and whatever handicaps or cripplings and so on that might be the case, or people who are funny looking like myself, whatever in the world, you know. But by the same token, when the it's instructive to me that in the eternal state you have the tree of life once again. And again, what it says in Genesis is, lest they eat of the tree and live forever, and that tree of life was there before the fall, as if to say that the tree of life was the key to their living forever. That makes sense to you? Had they gotten back in, they could have eaten it, and evidently they would have. I don't think it was once that they take a bite and you're perpetually immortal, but it would deliver you from whatever decay is involved in. Ultimately, physical death. So, okay, any other questions? What are you thinking about, you guys? Somebody's got to bring questions. Yeah, go. Religious, they call it the religious calendar and the civil calendar. Not essentially. It's just you got to figure out, really, the religious calendar. Its only function is the dates of the feasts. That's the only function of the religious calendar. I mean, today, They have to figure out when Nisan 14 is going to happen, because that's Passover. Now, you can go on a calendar today and you can look into whatever year you want, and they'll list all the dates, because you know they today it's a bit of a science. But nonetheless, that's pretty much all they do with the religious calendar. The civil calendar is what they live by. And that's why Rosh Hashanah, the reason I say it, to me it's kind of silly and confusing, is because Rosh Hashanah is always part of the high holy days, and in fact, that's intrinsic to the religious calendar, but Rosh Hashanah has only to do with the civil calendar. So to bring Rosh Hashanah in there seems to me, but I'm the only guy who's troubled by it. Everybody else just, all the Jews just keep it and don't ask any questions, you know. So, but that is what's going on. I visited with a guy up in Milwaukee a couple days ago, and he was totally confused by that. I don't understand how we can keep, how the Jews can regard this as Rosh Hashanah when the Bible says explicitly that the spring is supposed to be the beginning of the year. Well, that's the answer, is the civil versus the religious. Yeah, brother, come in, come in. Question? Oh, yes. Upon Adam, yes. Upon Adam, yes. But I think it was a function, I know what you're asking, and Romans 5:12, absolutely, by one man sin entered in, death by sin. But I don't think it was that some new element of humanity entered his life by which he was now liable to decay. I think death entered in the sense that he was deprived of the tree of life, and therefore his body began to decay. It's you know, I'll tell you what, as long as I brought it up, I always taught the otherwise. And I realize I'm a very, very strong creationist, and I love ICR, and I know that ICR and Answers in Genesis make a big thing of the fact that you can't have fossil death, you can't have fossils before creation, because, and I would functionally agree with that, although I do think that, I would functionally agree that the earth is young and that the fossils are post-Adam, let's put it that way. But I had a friend who was doing a doctorate at Westminster, and he asked me to help him with some research. And he was arguing for that reality, that God has crafted human life. It's an interesting thing. He had a Down syndrome boy, and it's a wonderful, wonderful story. And he was writing a set of counseling instruments to use with parents of a newborn child, you know, who's discovered to have that sort of a deficiency. And so, and one of the arguments he was making is that God has framed human existence in such a way that we are constantly reminded of our dependence upon Him, and he was arguing that. And I thought, Tom, you're crazy. The Bible's, but when I started to look at it real closely, and then when I went to practically every major theologian, they were on his side. It gets kind of complicated. But suffice it to say that my only distinction there is that I think the Romans 5:12 point is not that indeed death did enter, but it wasn't because man was constitutionally changed. It was because man was deprived of the tree of life, and thus he was liable to death. I do think there would have been animal death before that. And that's at that point that I'm out of, you know, I've had this conversation with Ken Ham and so on, and I make absolutely no headway, whatever. But I don't think that their argument is at all compromised. I mean, that particular plank is compromised, but their overall argument is not compromised. I have little points of heresy here, and I probably shouldn't bring them up, but yeah. Yeah, good. Get myself in trouble. All right, any other questions? Yeah. From 132 AD, or no? No. There was a man named Akiva who, look, You know that there was a Jewish revolt in 66 AD that resulted in the destruction of the temple by Titus Vespasian in 70 AD, right? That's called the Zealot Revolt. What many people don't remember, or we don't talk about quite as much, is that there was a second Jewish revolt in 132 AD now. In other words, about 60 years later. And it's called the Bar Kokhba Revolt. And Simon Bar Kokhba was a pretender Messiah. And there was a rabbi who was very, very powerful, very influential, who who embraced him as Messiah, actually gave him the name Bar Kokhba. Bar Kokhba or Bar Kokhba means, K-O-C-H-B-A, means son of a star. And the Jewish, in the Jewish mind, they always connected Messiah with a star because of the Balaam prophecy. A star shall arise out of Jacob. Remember that? And so they connected, they gave him this name, Simon Bar Kokhba. And it was Rabbi Akiva, and that's 130 years. I mean, but he was very, very influential. And now I'll tell you what may be at stake here, and this is a little extra, but just real quickly. Did I mention here that after 70 AD, I think I did, that the Jews were deprived of a temple, and they had still to this day do not have a temple, of course. And so they have very carefully recrafted Judaism. You want to get a feel for things Jewish. Let me recommend a book. It is such a delightful book. I actually referenced this man in another setting yesterday. His name is Herman Wouk, W-O-U-K. He is my all-time favorite author. If you've not read Herman Wouk, you have... I'm jealous. I wish I were just starting out. I love Herman Wouk. I don't enjoy everything he wrote, but Wouk is most famous for Caine Mutiny. You know Caine Mutiny, the story with Humphrey Bogart, you know, and that's his story, the mutiny of the USS Caine, the minesweeper. And he wrote Marjorie Morningstar, and it's kind of a chick thing. But he wrote two of the most monumental, well, it's actually one story, but if you enjoy historical fiction, really, really well done. His two books, Winds of War and War and Remembrance, I just can't say enough for it. But the story of the Second World War, Winds of War and War and Remembrance, but about 2,600 pages between the two of them, but I reread it every 4 or 5 years. The first one is called Winds of War, and the second volume is called War and Remembrance. I don't want to spend too much time with it, but he's very Jewish. Pardon me? Oh, look at this guy. Eric, you are good. You are good. They are really worth reading. They are some of the most compelling books. The first time I read it, it almost cost me my marriage because I would sneak off and hide. I just couldn't quit reading. My wife would have to look for me. And the last time I read it, I mean, it was probably the fifth time I've read it, and I swear, I'd be watching the news, and I'd say, well, that's all fine and good, but what about what's happening in Italy? Oh, that's my book. You know, I get so into these things. But all that aside, Herman Wouk wrote a book called This Is My God. Do you see that, Eric? And This Is My God, it's really a fascinating story. I'm going to come back where I was, but This Is My God. Wouk was raised in a thoroughly Jewish home. I mean, Orthodox Jewish home. When he was a boy of about 8, as I recall, his grandfather, who spoke no English, fled from Russia and moved in with them in their little Brooklyn flat, you know, fled the shtetl in Russia and Wouk tells a story of about how, you know, on the first Saturday morning after his grandfather had moved in, he was laying in bed, little Herman was, and he felt this, you know, big hand on his shoulder and rustled him and got him up and dragged him into the kitchen and set him down at the kitchen table. I had a big Talmud told, and his grandfather said the one word he had learned in English, and that was read. And so Herman started studying Talmud, and all his life he studied Talmud under his grandfather, and he's really, really... But then he went off to the Navy, and then he went out as a young man in the 50s to write gags for Milton Berle on the nascent TV industry. And when he got out there, he was, for the first time in his life, powerfully confronted with the reality that if he was going to live as a Jew, he was going to stand out. If he was going to keep kosher and keep Shabbat, that he was going to be announced. He says, every time, this is so big, by the way, it relates to what we've been talking about. You know those laws, for instance, that God gave concerning diet, the dietary laws, what we call kashrut. There are definitely some hygienic and salubrious qualities and all that sort of thing, but more than anything else, it sets you apart. Just in the normal course of the day, as you sit down to eat, you have to kind of announce, I'm a Jew. And Wouk makes the point, that's really what that's all about. You're a holy nation. You're a set-apart nation. If you live this way, just in the normal course of life, you're going to be announcing that you're a Jew. And Wouk, he kind of hit a wall in his life as a young man in his early 20s, and it was kind of a life-shaping thing, and he determined that he was, in fact, going to live out his Judaism, but he wanted to explain it to his goy friends, and so he wrote a book called This Is My God. Now, woke is the greatest wordsmith I've ever read. I love to read him. I do it with in the back of his books, any one of the books I've read, I write the words down, and I go to the dictionary, and I look them up, and I try and use them in the next 4 or 5 days, you know, because he's such a wordsmith. But in his book, This Is My God, thoroughly, thoroughly unbelieving. He's not a believer at all, not a Christian. He's not anti-Christian at all, and he understands Christianity, but he's certainly not a Christian. I really honor the man. I can't tell you. I'll tell you another part of that story, and this is what I mentioned earlier. Interestingly enough, he writes this book, and that's what I was going to say. This Is My God so winsomely and effectively and delightfully introduces you to things Jewish. Now, it's modern. It's contemporary Judaism, although he has a lot of history and he understands it well. Later in his life, and I think I just asked this fellow I met at the airport a couple of weeks ago. He's very, very Jewish. And I asked him if Woke was still alive. He knew Woke well. And I think he still is. He must be into his 90s. But he has a home in Netanya, just north of Tel Aviv, and then one in San Diego. But late in his life, he wrote a book called The Will to Live On. And he measures the wisdom of that decision he made when he was... In other words, it's kind of the other bookend. And you think, who does this? You know, who lives his life? So, you know, has that kind of a life-shaping decision as a young man? And then 70 years later, looks back and assesses the wisdom of it. And I mean, the will to live on, you got to fall in love with Woke to appreciate. This Is My God, you'll love just as it is. But at any rate, but he says in that book, this is what got me talking about Woke. He says in that book, he talks about what is called the Jamnia Academy. And what happened, and this is where I was taking it, this really becomes important. What happened is that when the temple was destroyed in AD 70, see, before the temple was destroyed, you had all of these Jewish sects. You had the Essenes, and you had the Pharisees, and you had the Sadducees, and you had Herodians, and all these things that show up in the New Testament, the Zealots and so on. All of them perished when the temple was destroyed, except the Pharisees. The Pharisees survived. And they reconvened at a little village called Jamnia, and they had the authorization of the Roman authorities. The Roman authorities gave them leave to more or less codify Judaism. Now, the upshot of that is they did codify Judaism, and we have it in the Mishnah and the Gemara and the Talmud and so on, but the codification of Judaism that today is Orthodox Judaism. Now, it has different expressions, but there's a remarkable sameness. As a matter of fact, a sameness which is relatively modern. Judaism has not been monolithic until Jamnia. But by reason of the fact that they were deprived of the temple and they had to craft a religion or a way to give expression to their Jewishness or to live out their Jewishness, and it happened at Jamnia. And the point is that Rabbinic Judaism is Pharisaism. Or to say it another way, Orthodox Judaism today is almost point for point the Pharisaism of the New Testament that Jesus resisted. The parallel is uncanny. Now, the way they live it out, to the degree that it connected with the temple, they can't do that any longer. And as a matter of fact, and I think I said to you before, but the three great portable factors were circumcision, kosher, and Shabbat. And it is. I was in Israel one time. I got to tell you a story just real quickly. And my dad was coming to join me, and I'd been there a few days, and I had to go down to the airport to pick him up. So we get out of the airport. I go down to the airport, pick him up, and we get a cheroot. The cheroot is a communal taxi. About 6 people in there, it's Friday, and in the front seat we're sitting in the jump seat. Behind us is this woman and her son. She's just flown in from Paris. She doesn't speak much English, but you know, we talked a little bit. She's a very, very aristocratic, well-dressed, well-heeled woman. And in the front was a thoroughly Hasidic Jew. You know, everything about him was totally, totally Hasidic. And so we start up the hill toward Jerusalem. It's Friday. He's watching his watch. And he can't be in that car after sundown. And sundown is published in the newspaper, 7:14, whatever it's going to be. So he knows the exact time at which he's got to get out of that car. And he is slipping 100 shekel notes to that cab driver. And the cab driver, this is turning into an e-ride. You know, we are just tearing up around. And he keeps slipping these 100 shekel notes over there, and he gooses it again, you know, and off we go. Oh, it was a ride. But the interesting thing to me was that he lived in what's called Mea Shearim, which is the Orthodox neighborhood in Jerusalem. And this Parisian woman was going to the home of her son, which was in the outskirts. And we had to drive right by her house in order to get into Mea Shearim. And when it became apparent, of course, who was slipping who the 100 shekel notes, you know, and when it became very apparent that cab driver was going to go, first of all, to Mea Shearim, she just flew into a rage. And I mean to tell you what was going on between the two of them, you know, it was remarkable. So, and we never got to that Orthodox Jew's house because he's okay, stop. And he got out of the car and hauled all his stuff and went shuffling down the street carrying all that luggage, you know, because he was not going to be in that car. And he must have been within the Sabbath day's journey, but he was carrying a lot of stuff, but I didn't point it out to him. But what struck me was that by the time we turn around and, you know, because we're right about just four blocks from our hotel, but I said, no, take her home first. So we went out there with her. By the time we got there, that woman was as distraught as any woman I've ever seen. Now, this is a very fine Parisian woman. She was sobbing. Her son had to help her into the house, you know, because she had been in a car for maybe 20 minutes on Shabbat. I mean, I tell you can't imagine. That's how serious she was. And it's just the way they live. Kosher. You know, the interesting thing about kosher is that the single most important, you know what it is? The thing that is most important to them with regard to kosher. I mean, you think of the ham and all that sort of stuff. You know, they don't eat pork, that's to be sure. But the thing that is they really struggle with the most, I mean, they work the hardest, you know what it is? You don't mix dairy and meat. That is huge, to where they have separate kitchens. They have separate utensils. You can't, you know, you can never have any dairy in the beef kitchen. You can never, you know, and they get that all from a verse in Numbers that says, you're not to seethe the kid in his mother's milk, which frankly, nobody in the world knows what that means. Now, I read an interesting article on it not too long ago, and they said, this was an interesting thing. They said, probably what it means is, you know, they never fried, or they always boiled their food. And they would craft these pots. And normally, they would use ceramic pots that were burned in a kiln, and they were very, very, when they would boil meat. But anything they used to fix dairy products, they would take cord and, I mean, fabric, and they would make it, and then they would cover it with clay, and it was deliberately very porous because they wanted, you know what I'm talking about, gals? They wanted the yogurt. They wanted the starter. They wanted that. It stunk, you know, but if you had a pot that you had used to fix what is yogurt to them, but, you know, this stuff that ages and so on, you know what I'm talking about? If you had a pot, you could buy a new pot for nothing, but if you had a pot that was 20 years old and stunk like crazy, you'd spend a fortune for that because that's what you needed so desperately to fix the dairy products in that would what's the word I want? You know, like ferment and curd, and then you get curds. So this article was saying that that's the point, that you never fix the meat with the container that was intended for the milk because it would spoil. I don't know. But nobody knows for sure what it means, but on the other hand, out of that, they derive this idea that you can't mix dairy and meat. And, pardon me? Yeah, it's huge. Separate kitchen, separate, I mean, a good hotel. And here's the thing, I'll tell you what, not to go too far with it, but Yad HaShemana, I told you about Yad HaShemana yesterday, you know, the moshav where you can go and volunteer for a year if you want, or 6 months or 3 months or whatever. Well, it's a Christian outfit, but of late, they just struggled, and so they made a determination, and it was a gut-wrenching determination. It was one of these scenes where they all met in the dining hall and talked about it several times and fought and scrapped, and they finally decided, because they had always served only Christians. They only wanted Christians to come. They serve meals, you can come. They have hotel, you know, rooms and so on. But they decided they were just going to have to open themselves to the Jewish public. It's a huge thing in Israel. In Israel, when they go on vacations, they go get a hotel room. Might be down the street. It's the craziest thing. You never want to be trying to go to Israel during one of the feasts because all the Jews are going to the hotel. And they just live in a hotel. I mean, it's this weird thing. But or one of the, and so this place is, they knew they could, they'd have a much bigger market if they, but in order to do that, they had to begin. They had always been kosher. They had always been quite carefully kosher. But now they had to be formally kashrut. You know what that meant? They had to pay the entire living wages of a rabbi whose responsibility is to inspect the place. And he walks around and, you know, constantly looking in every pot. And the guy they were assigned just happened to despise Christians. And it turned into a huge issue. Oh, a huge issue. And this guy was constantly threatening to yank their kashrut license, and they were spent their whole life dancing to his tune, you know. And last I heard, I mean, they were still doing it, but they were, of course, you can imagine now the people who were voting against in the first place were mad about the other thing. But they had to separate their kitchen. That's the biggest part of it, is making sure that it's really a little nuts, but I don't know. Yeah, for a long time, you know, now there were certain places. You go to Tel Aviv, you can get a cheeseburger. But Jerusalem, you can never get a cheeseburger, you know. And you can't have cream with your coffee in the afternoon. You can't have breakfast because it's a dairy. But, you know, when you at lunch, you want cream with your coffee, they won't give it to you because, you know, you got meat out there. So it becomes, you got to work at it. Okay, any other questions that are pertinent to what we're talking about here? Like that makes any difference, right? No, I haven't. I've written some essays, which you'll find on the internet there. But I'm supposed to submit a book proposal this summer to David C. Cook on the Passion Week. I hope to do it on the Passion Week. Yeah. So pray for me in that regard. By the way, here's an interesting little thing I think you ought to pray for just before you go to bed tonight. You know the name Stephen Hawking? Brief History of Time. You know his wife is an evangelical Christian? Pardon me? Oh, he did? Well, the one who has cared for him ever since he had his disease, and I don't think this one, I don't know about an earlier wife, but this one has cared for him and... He's in the hospital. He's very seriously sick, I heard today. And Stephen Hawking is just this remarkably intelligent man who wrote a book called A Brief History of Time. He did it because he couldn't afford to put his kids in college. And it became just a huge bestseller. He's a secular atheist evolutionist. But... he's been powerfully impacted. He goes to church on occasion with his wife. His wife is faithful in church and has raised their son, you know, I think she's quite frankly a Catholic, but she's very serious about, or she's of some liturgical high church ilk. But yeah, that's Stephen Hawking. Oh yeah, he's ill. He's totally paralyzed. He's got a wheelchair that enables him to communicate with whatever little tiny motor ability he has. It's Lou Gehrig's disease, I believe. And, you know, it's a tragedy of the first order, but I don't know. He has, in fact, had a powerful testimony to him, caring for him. I mean, and she insists that she loves her husband dearly, but it's because of, you know, her faith that she's given herself to that. So that'd be pretty powerful. Who knows? It'd be nice to hear that Stephen Hawking had claim the Lord. Will?
Tomorrow night.
6:30. See you there. Thanks much, folks.